Welcome back to Tasteland. I am your co-host, Francis Zier.
And I'm Daisy Alioto.
How's it going today, Daisy?
It's going really well. It's February. It's not January anymore. And yeah, and thank God. You know, that's one thing that we can be grateful for.
Okay, one funny thing I want to talk about is my college mascot. They're renaming the college, changing the college mascot, and they sent out a survey last week. So, like, for context, I went to Lewis and Clark College, and of course, Lewis and Clark, problematic guys, perhaps famously. And the mascot for however long, I don't know, used to be an all women's college, by the way, like 100 years ago, then co-ed. Anyways, I don't know what the mascot was back then, but the mascot for when I was there and however long before was the dog on the Lewis and Clark expedition, which was a black or Newfoundland named Seaman.
His name was what?
S-E-A-M-A-N.
Okay.
Seaman.
Keep going. Yeah, Seaman. Keep going.
You know, very funny to generations of college students, but they're changing it because of woke, I believe.
How did this survive anything?
I don't know. But they gave us the opportunity to submit three ideas for new mascots with 100 words of justification or so.
I mean, keep Seaman. Just change the suit.
Change the suit. Please change the suit. I hope the suit has been changed. I want you to rate my three ideas that I submitted. It's in Portland.
Yeah,
one is hill. Not hills. Hill. Portland's a city of hills. It's up there on Palatine Hill. So just a hill. I figure the hill is a strong thing. Great for sports.
I rate that very low.
Okay. Here's my second one. Forest.
These are terrible ideas. Is that one or two R's?
You've caught me out. It's one R because that's what a forest is.
Gump.
The two R's is the name. But again, it's in the forest. I think a forest is a strong thing. It's made of many trees, just like a sports team, made of many strong people.
Yeah.
So forest.
Dazzle me.
Final one. The bridges, because there's a lot of bridges in Portland, city of bridges. So bridges, forest, or hill. Okay, I'm getting that you think these are all terrible. Sure,
this is so fair. I love lamp coated.
Look, I thought you would appreciate this. From you run a magazine called Dirt. Okay, come on.
Didn't name it. It's honestly like this is like you looked out your window and just started like naming things. I'll tell you what it was.
Yeah, no, okay. It's I talked about this. I read a passage from this on the last episode because I just read Hill by Sean Giono.
Don't do that again.
So I'm sure.
What if
I'm
we call
sure
it
hated that.
Another NYRB classic, famous Stoner.
Stoner.
Also an appropriate mascot for
the Stoner.
Lewis and Clark.
It is.
College.
Yeah.
The Stoners.
Yeah, that would be a great nickname.
Email them and tell them you made a mistake.
I can't. They can only submit three ideas, and I stand by my three ideas.
Okay, fine. Well, I mean, so my college was the Polar Bears, but
not even in the Arctic Circle.
No, that's way cooler. Because Perry was the explorer, like he was an alum, and we had a taxidermy polar bear. It's a whole thing. Okay. But it used to be the sun. Because
we had a taxidermy Newfoundland dog. We did not.
Was it? No, but that wasn't Seaman.
Look, I don't know. I was not on the expedition. We didn't have it. We did not have a taxidermy dog, though.
I mean, you wouldn't have been asked.
I never went to a sports game. I've never in college never supported our Seaman.
I was a cheerleader.
You were really?
Yeah, I'm not.
This is
my friend Helen
lore.
Says I can't talk about it anymore or post. Photo. She says it's attention seeking behavior.
It is.
But I'm like, if you had photos of you in a cute cheerleading costume, you would post them too.
Yeah. Well, that's like, I feel like those go on ice and then you kind of seed them to your children in 15 years so they can post about them on Red Note or whatever.
You're right. Like, my mom was hot.
Exactly.
I think they'll be a little too busy in the water wars.
Have you ever seen Waterworld?
Is that a film?
I haven't seen it. So, but yeah, it's like a Kevin Costner vehicle.
I haven't because you know what? I just watched American Psycho for the first time this weekend.
Okay. You sound like me last week when I was like, I've never watched a David Lynch.
Well, that got to me. So yeah. I did watch American Psycho. I did a Fight Club, which I had seen.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And American Psycho double feature. Very interesting back-to-back, released in back-to-back years. Yeah. Jared Leto's in both of them.
Oh, I'm like, he is?
And Justin Theroux, I think.
But I feel like hating Jared Leto is like annoying. It's too obvious. But water. I hate Jared Leto.
Okay.
Do you like him? He has great hair, yeah.
I don't know. I don't know anything.
Okay, whatever. that's fine.
Wait, I wasn't done with the mascot story. Okay, so original mascot was the Suns because Bowdoin was the easternmost college in the United States. So the idea was the sun rises on Bowdoin. Wow,
the Massachusetts just jumped out.
It does come out sometimes. Ben says it comes out if I'm like really heated or if I'm a little bit drunk, which really isn't that often.
Are you potting drunk right now?
No, not at all. No. Okay, I'm just under the influence.
Okay, the mascot. It was the easternmost.
Love. Easternmost college. So that was the sun rises on Bowdoin. And then apparently there's a period where it was like the Fighting Pines. Mm. And then, of course, the polar bears. But interesting thing about Fighting Pines, Portland, Maine just got a soccer team.
They did.
It's called the Hearts of Pine. And it's sponsored by L.L. Bean. And they posted a great video, which I'm sure you saw me repost, of all the guys getting duck boots.
It's very cool.
But Ben says that Westchester County is also getting a team now, which is, we live in Westchester County, technically. And
they're getting
they're going to play each other.
Okay.
So.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Are you going to buy an L.L. Bean Heart of Pines jersey?
I think so. I mean, I think I'm going to buy one for us to share. Mm. And Josh also of Night Gallery fame showed me his next drop. And I would say it's like extremely targeted towards anyone that was in college between the years 2009 and 2013.
Nice.
And it already picked out something from there that we're going to have joint custody of.
Anyways, our guest Tatum is here.
Okay.
So
our guest today is my friend Tatum Dooley. And she is the creator of Art Forecast, which is a newsletter. She's also a curatorial consultant, a critic, and a writer, which is how we met. And I'm very excited to have her on the podcast today.
Let's chat with Tatum. Hello, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Hey, Tatum.
Doing good.
All right, well, much to talk about today. Okay. Francis's other podcast is called Creator Spotlight. We talk a lot on this podcast about the difference between like creators and traditional editorial workers. And then there's also kind of this dichotomy between artists and creators.
I think of this like creator, right? With like the implicit content before it is like, there's this creative to entrepreneur spectrum. Maybe it's not like just like a one, you know, it's not just a straight line, but for sake of argument. But we were talking about your artists should have newsletters issue. Back to you, Daisy.
Back to me. Yeah. So, I mean, the confusing thing about it is like the demands of being a creator seem like they're in conflict with most artists, unless you're like an Amalia Ullman and you're doing creation as a sort of like you're behaving as a creator. Yeah. As like a performance art thing, which I mean, at this point, like goes back to Warhol and is not even particularly subversive these days. So how, like, to me, your artist should have newsletters is like just taking into account the reality that everyone has an audience and an audience is potential buyers. But like, how do you balance this idea of being an artist with what you write about, which is like sort of the ways in which artists have to function as entrepreneurs? You're also married to an artist, so you see it like firsthand.
I think most artists I know are entrepreneurs. I think in an ideal world, we could just let artists be artists, but it's just not the reality. You know, there are some really big galleries that take on most of that work for their artists, if it's marketing and media, PR, Instagram, you know, that you have a studio, but that's at like a really high level. Most artists have to do part of that themselves. And I think that there are things that artists do that really like lends itself to being an entrepreneur. So I kind of, when I'm talking about that on my newsletter, it's kind of like giving permission, be like, you can be that entrepreneur for yourself as well. I think Daisy and I, we've seen the way that like media has changed so much and that we've had to do that for ourselves. In the best world, we would just be writers and I would just wake up every morning and, you know, write a book and write some poetry, but that's not the reality of the world we're in right now. And so you kind of do have to take on a little bit more ownership so that you're not like left out to sea when things change.
This is reminding me of a tweet I saw a couple weeks ago. I'm going to read it. Entrepreneurs need to teach artists how to love money and sell. Artists need to teach entrepreneurs how to develop taste and make beautiful things. The fact that these two despise each other is a net negative for humanity. Which, when I read this, I kind of was like, because I've been thinking that like the entrepreneurs are good at selling things, like in arbitraging attention to make money without having to worry. Like quality of art or craft or of content, let's say, right, is just like one possible part of a business model. It's not the only business model in town. Whereas like for somebody who is more coming from the artist perspective, like that is the business model. It's not the business model. It's like the value. It's the point, right? So I don't know. I thought this tweet kind of surprised me because I think that entrepreneurs actually, or artists don't need to teach entrepreneurs how to develop taste and make beautiful things because entrepreneurs don't have to do that to make money. But artists, to survive in the way you're saying, where it's like you have to make a living, kind of are obliged to learn these entrepreneurial tactics, right?
I mean, the premise of the tweet, though, I'm not sure if it's true. I don't know if entrepreneurs and artists hate each other. I think that there's some symbiotic relationships that happen between those two groups of people.
It's one of those things where you like reread it and it like it kind of feels true, but then the more you think about it, you're like, no, because if you take into account the wider political and economic landscape, these groups don't have equal access to capital.
Yeah.
And I mean, there is like the sort of taste economy thesis, which is like actually entrepreneurs will have to develop taste. But if you look at like where capital actually accrues, like in any instance where an artist teaches something to an entrepreneur, the entrepreneur will always benefit more than the artist.
Yes.
Because you can't raise venture capital for your studio practice. Like every artist is starting off from zero, needing to actually create something tangible unless they have real source of patronage, which successful entrepreneurs historically provided, and now they just take over the US government.
Yeah.
Which is another thing I've seen like a lot of chatter about. Like what happened to making money and giving it back to the arts as like a point of pride? And now as a point of pride, they spit on the arts. So I mean, Tatum, you are not in the United States, but I'm sure you're watching all of this unfold. And I know that like one thing I wanted to ask you about was the rebrand of your newsletter from Canadian Art Forecast to Art Forecast. Like you've done such a good job spotlighting your own sort of regional art scene and market, but the market is a global market and it's not really possible to talk about any sort of like artist group in isolation. So I'm curious, like how's that rebrand, which I think was about a year ago, gone for you? And how have you seen your audience change?
Yes, I'll definitely answer that. Before I almost thinking of what we were just chatting about, I wonder if we artists don't teach entrepreneurs taste, but they take like they allow them to perform taste. Mm-hmm. Like this idea of like faking taste by having the right art, which is kind of easy just to like copy and paste if you're in certain circles. So it's like I don't know if they teach want to know actually how to have taste. They just want to perform the idea of having taste and like having the right things in their collection. And yes, Canadian Art Forecast was the original brand. And then a year ago, I decided to drop the Canadian, although I'm like, maybe we should put it back. I'm feeling very proud to be Canadian. But it was for a few reasons, which is I think that I was needlessly limiting myself to a certain geographic area. And I still write about Canadian art a lot, but it doesn't need to be, you know, identified as that. It's, I have a larger audience now, and I feel like that's more beneficial to the Canadian artists that I work with and write about, because now their audience is in the United States, and it's in Ireland, it's in, you know, Australia. And that is the reality of the art market right now. It's global. I was also traveling a lot, going to a lot of art fairs. So I didn't, you know, I felt like I was growing when I started Canadian art. I was very like, you know, I was based in Toronto, and that was where I was seeing all my art. And then as my art experience was growing, I decided to rebrand the newsletter and the Instagram account along with it. And it was also just like investing in myself and really then like taking it seriously, like spending money to do the rebrand. I like love the way it looks. It looks so professional. It looks like exactly like what I'm trying to do. You know, it's kind of fun. It's a little bit like colorful. It's all of the things that I want Art Forecast to be. And so I feel like I've like grown into it a little bit more.
I want to talk about your trend predictions in the newsletter at the top of this year, which you kind of, you kind of bait the reader in by saying the trend predictions, but then you kind of hedge that like, no, no, nobody can predict the future. It's actually futures, whatever. But I'm just going to read the five, and I'd love you to speak to them. Okay. There'll be exhibitions with 1 to 3 artworks total. More galleries will close while others will open with experimental formats. There'll be a move towards artist agents and managers instead of galleries. There'll be less corporate collecting. And Gagosian will name a successor.
Yes. I mean, that's kind of like their trend predictions in quotation marks, because I think they're kind of things I just maybe want to see happen. And I'm so putting it into the world.
You're their manifestations.
Prophecy. Yeah. Yeah. So starting with number one, just having like singular pieces of art. And I think that it's like our attention economy. It's like we're used to seeing so many things. It would be nice just to like focus on one thing. And that's, I think, like a task that they do in art school is like you have to go to a museum and look at a single painting for 30 minutes and you really start to learn about it more. And so I really love the idea of having an exhibition about that. It also kind of moves it away from profit-based. You're going to have 20 paintings because then you'll make more money. But what does it mean just to have one painting and really just ask the viewer to pay attention to that closely?
Have you been to any shows recently that were like that?
I've been to museums that do that. They'll like hang their like one, you know, in Toronto at the AGO, we have our Rubens in a single room. And it's just like through the structure of that, it's just saying this is a very important piece that you need to pay attention to. And so museums definitely do that. And it's like corporate collections, or not corporate, commercial galleries, maybe less so. Nothing's coming to mind.
I mean, I think of like the Dia Foundation, like everything they do is, not everything they do, but so much of what they do is that.
Very minimal.
Mm-hmm. Famously, the caretakers of the Earth Room, which we talk about all the time on this podcast. You've been, right, Tina?
I haven't. I think.
Do you want to go when you're in town?
Yes.
We can go together. It's settled.
It's a date. We always see art together.
We do. Yeah. I was thinking, actually, Helen, my friend Helen texted me at Hilma AF Clint painting before this podcast started. And it was the dirt coated. And I was thinking about when we went to the show at the Guggenheim.
This is the Tree of Life one.
Yeah.
Yeah. You posted it.
Did I post it recently?
I think you did. I think you posted it like an hour ago on Twitter.
Me?
I think so. Anyways, moving on.
Whatever. Anyway, Francis, you and I might be plugged in a little bit too much to the Matrix, but
probably.
Yeah, I have some photos of Tatum at the Guggenheim looking at that together.
How nice. Yeah.
And then the other prediction, I mean, we have seen galleries continually closing. You know, the market is down in the art world. I like to think it's course correcting versus down, but that is causing galleries to close, which is really unfortunate. But galleries are also opening. And I think we're seeing more, you know, people opening a gallery in their living room or a laundromat or, you know, creative spaces, as well as rotating gallery models. And I think that it's just really a smart move that will end up like benefiting both the art and the artists. Yeah, the artist agent one was a very interesting one. That's what I got the most emails for. And like people being like, great, like, I'd love to work with you. Can you help me do all of these things that you're saying? Which goes back to that first thing, which is like, should artists be entrepreneurs? I'm like, no, if you don't want to, you could probably hire somebody to help you.
I think that's probably the case for most people. Like not just artists, but like actors have agents, right? Like most people who are prioritizing creative work should speak the language of like the business side, but should have somebody else doing it.
Yeah, I agree. And it's always just like nice to have somebody in your corner, like somebody that you're working with that's advocating for you. If that's not going to be a gallerist because that model doesn't make sense for you, you know, it can be an agent or it could just be like you have somebody that helps you with your communications and social media, whatever you don't want to do. It's always a good idea
to
get somebody else to do it.
I feel like I'm a momager for some of my friends that are writers too.
Yeah, what do you?
Because even in industries that have agents, there's a lot that agents can't do or don't do.
Like what?
They don't pitch out. Like if you have a book agent, they don't necessarily pitch out your essays or like nonfiction, shorter nonfiction, to other publications. You don't necessarily like come up with ideas to pitch together for short form stuff. And they don't necessarily help you with your marketing. So all of those things.
Can you do this? I'm like, I want to hire you, Daisy.
There's no money exchange. This is, it sort of has come naturally because, I don't know if you feel this way, Tatum, through like you go to a studio visit, you see somebody that's like up and coming, you want to get in on the ground floor. And the best way to help them is through some of this, like just like executive level strategy stuff. Like I feel the same way. Like when I have a young writer or a talented person, like kind of come into the sphere of dirt and I'm publishing them, I start to take an interest in them being published like more widely, even beyond dirt. And like starting to build their career. And it's hard not to be involved if you have that instinct.
Yeah, I feel the exact same way. Like you're opting it. You're like, there's a buy-in. You're like, I'm invested in your success because I believe in what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I actually wanted to ask you about the studio visit. I guess it's not directly in those predictions, but sort of feels tangential where everyone's talking about URL to IRL, people really want in-person interactions again. Like, I feel like the studio visit could play an important role in that. And I really liked the one that you did with Janine Brito because I was already following her on Instagram, but it was really cool to see photos from inside her studio, the actual like materiality of it. And then I saw one of her pieces is, I think, the UK book cover for Sophie Kemp's Paradise Logic book, which has been kind of buzzed about in my book circle. So that was a cool connection. But I guess, like, what is the power of the studio visit in like 2025?
Yeah, I've actually been thinking about writing a newsletter on studio visit rules. Firstly, like, I think people don't realize, like, you can just email any artist that you like and ask to go for a studio visit. That's like part of artist practices. Some people might say no. They might say, you know, they don't have work or if they're too busy, but a lot of people will say yes. And it's a really great way to both like meet the person, you know, demystify the artist a little bit. They're just everyday people. Ask questions, learn more about their work, like see the environment where they're working as well as works in progress. And then in terms of like studio visit rules, is like I do hear horror stories from artists about like the way people act, like picking up like their paintbrushes and like playing with things, like just don't touch anything in a studio visit. Ask before you take photos. Don't post photos. Most people don't like to have works
hands
in progress
clasped
posted
behind the back the whole time.
Yeah, like really, it's like if you ever see like children at a museum, like a school group, and they have to like all be like have their hands held, yeah, like so they don't touch the art. That's like, think back to that and don't touch anything. Like don't give unsolicited negative feedback.
Yeah,
things like that.
I've heard from like female artists too, there's people who will like, especially like attractive young women, there's people who will like feign an interest in the work just to get like proximity, and I just think that's like so gross.
yeah, criminal. Like, that's really a weird thing to do.
Just, it is weird.
Like a date, just like a, like to trying to turn a studio visit into like, oh, this is a date. Like,
yeah, yeah. But men have been doing that like forever, right? Yeah, they're always like, oh, I'd but love I to, do like, think have a coffee. And
that's like, true.
This is a
that's
date.
True. I think because like, I don't know, the studio is like a fixed place and it's like a sacred place. Mm-hmm. Like when somebody like wants to like pick my brain and it ends up just being like a psycho violation, I'm like, that's fine. Like, I mean, I can't get a new brain, but we're going to move on from that. But like, if you have people like repeatedly like invading your studio under the auspices of one interest, and it's actually a different interest. Like, that's tough because it's a physical space and you can't pick up and move. And maybe you can't afford to say no to people not knowing whether the interest is genuine or not.
Yeah. There needs to be like vetting. I wonder if in that case, artists can be like, I'm having an open studio between the hours of 3 and 4 on Wednesday. And then they get multiple people to come at the same time, as well as like a few friends, just to kind of like create some boundaries.
I've thought about doing open studio for picking my brain. That's just awesome. Dump everyone in the
that
same
terrible.
Zoom invite.
That sounds...
Well, just because nobody wants to pick your brain doesn't mean...
Look, people, you know what I've been saying recently when people ask for, especially because I have an open role right now, and so people really want to talk to me, some
people
want
to talk to me about your open role, Francis.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's okay to ask.
But no, I've been saying, like, I mean, my line has been, look, like, there's a lot of applicants, and I can't do an extracurricular conversation about the role right now, but like, if you have one or two questions, feel free to send them and I'll write you back a response. Mm-hmm. And usually they don't reply because it's, again, it's like they don't really have the question. And I get it. I mean, I would do that too. I do that. You should always ask like, oh, could we have a chat or whatever? But I'm always going to say no.
I always say yes. I think it's so important. I mean, I'm probably being asked less than both of you.
Well, okay. What types of people are asking you, and what is the power and economic differential?
I mean, specifically too, about because I'm hiring for this job right now. It's like, I'm talking to enough people. Like, I'll reach out to you. I've looked at your application and I will reach out to talk to you when it's time to talk to you. But
no, that's a different dynamic. I feel like young writers, young artists, I'll always go to the studio if I'm invited. I'll try to go to the opening if I'm invited. I'll go for coffee. And I feel like what I've heard from young writers or artists is that people are like telling them they're like, run away when you can. Like, this is an awful industry. And that really gets under my skin, because we need to be offering support to younger artists, writers, instead of just being like, we've made it, now we're like pulling up the ladder. So I try to go out of my way and be like,
I feel like that's also like any industry I can think of is like, I can think of somebody saying about that. Like, I'm currently work in like at a software company. I've worked in kitchens, like, you know, I've worked in coffee. I feel like I've heard that of every single industry I've worked in, like run away. I don't know.
That's I think we all deep down know the difference between mentorship and like free consulting. Mm-hmm. This sort of came up on the podcast with like Emily Sundberg too, but sometimes it's hard because like, if your industry is like attractive enough and the barrier to entry is low, which is sort of the case with writing, but not necessarily art, because you would actually have to create something. There's so many dilettantes that they can sort of like be like, oh, I'm seeking mentorship. But what they're really looking for is free consulting, because their relationship to the industry is not to be a player. It's to basically just like pick off some status from people who are actually creating things. And I do get that vibe from like a lot of entrepreneurs as well, which is why I don't think the exchange between entrepreneurs and artists can be even for the most part.
I agree with that.
You could disagree though. Like,
no, I fully agree with that. No, that's kind of my whole point, is that like, it's never going to be equal, because the entrepreneur always has like the understanding of how to actually make money and like create the revenue streams or whatever, whereas the artist does not have that. And so like, they are very simply like at a huge disadvantage in the market.
Yeah. I still want to give more credit to artists though. Yeah. Like, artists definitely know how to make money. I know a lot
definitely
of artists that make significant money. They understand how markets work. They understand, you know, they have to deal with secondary markets and bubbles and the strategy involved with that. Like, there is nuance to the art market.
Yeah. I think I'm like, the way I'm framing it too is definitely in like the context of like newsletters, because that's what I cover. So like when my like creator entrepreneur spectrum is like somebody who's like a really good writer, mm-hmm. writing a newsletter, versus somebody who's like made like a profitable like local news newsletter, as some people I've spoken mm-hmm. to have. And it's like he's like this guy I'm thinking of, he's really good at making money, and he doesn't have to work with journalists to produce like original local reporting, because yeah. that would be a net negative on you know, that would cut very cut into his bottom line in a big way. So I think with let's say painters, it's a little bit different.
Speaking of the secondary market, Tatum, you worked at Peggy, which was a platform that was working to solve the problem of like artist royalties, that mm-hmm. you know, you get money off the first sale, but there's no like unless it's like written into the contract for the sale, there's not a royalties mechanism in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. Some people in Web3 and the blockchain thought that that would be a way to solve that. Peggy is like a marketplace that like sort of enforced that, is my understanding. Like, what is sort of the state of this royalties question, and like how are artists navigating around it? Like the savvier ones, like you mentioned. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like it was a really hot topic like 4 years ago, and it's less pressing right now for some reason. I think the thing with art and tech, I'm kind of like skeptical of it, because the art world is so opaque, and tech, I think the premise of it is transparent. And so people don't really love to touch or like combine the two, because they don't like the transparency that you would need in order to have like a really smooth royalties process. Most galleries now do get their collectors to sign a contract that often has royalties included. If that's being honored, honestly, I'm not sure. I do know some people will like honor it out of like a, you know, they want to keep working with this artist or this gallery, and they want to keep a good relationship, so they offer the royalties kind of out of the goodness of their heart, as well as wanting to continue to get access to the art. Yeah, I mean, something like in the UK, it is like the law that artists get royalties. So I feel like that would be a more viable route to ensure that artists
get paid. How long has it been the law there?
I'm not sure. Yeah, I can't even guess, but it's been a law for a while.
So we sort of touched on this with like saying yes to the studio visit, saying yes to meeting the young artist. Like, to me, that sort of falls under your writing about the artist first approach to art. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to like read off a quote from that newsletter that you wrote. An artist first approach to art means following a young artist's career, showing up at openings, and offering support and opportunities in multiple forms. Mm-hmm. It also means extending care to art workers outside of the public eye, cleaners, art handlers, security guards, life models, and art movers, to name a few. All of the people who make the art world move behind the scenes. Can you talk a little bit about like writing that and, mm-hmm. you know, how you put that into practice?
Yeah. I sometimes think in the art world, we focus on collectors and galleries because they're like the sexiest, they make the most money, they're flashy, they're fun, they're cool. And I was really like, through writing about art for the last decade, just came to this conclusion that like what I love about art is the artist. Like everything I want to do is in support of artists. Like they're just, I don't know, like they're very special to me, like not like as an abstract thing, but like just like in my life, like the people around me that I love the most are artists, and they really teach me a lot about how to look at the world. And then it's kind of more of a question of like, how can everybody else in the art world be of service to them and not be like trying to take advantage and like make the most money off of them, but be like, what are the conditions that we can create for artists to exist in the world and make the best art possible. And yeah, I feel like I've come back to this idea of the artist first approach again and again in my writing. Sometimes it peaks out.
Yeah. You also wrote, if we strip the market of the commodification of work, the ego leaves with it in its place, a community develops, relationships form, and art holds more meaning. With an artist first approach to art, we give artists the space and resources to create their best work, showing care to everyone who stands in front of the art. Sort of makes me think of like Fran Lebowitz panel that I saw like in 2020. And she said something like, There's no art world. There's only like an art market or something, basically commenting on the fact that like, we don't call it the music market, you know, we don't call it the literature market. But art is very commodified, but you don't necessarily have to participate in that market in every way. There's, you can opt in and opt out. But people might not feel like they have that power. So that's why I like your newsletter, because it feels like a realistic but empowerment focused set of like advice and ways of thinking about the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. Sometimes I find myself interchanging art market and art world in my writing, and I'm like, what am I doing? I prefer to say art world because like the art market feels so focused on the commodity side of it and the buying. And then I feel like sometimes the newsletter is me like working through some of those things in real time, because I do think the buying is important. I like to collect art when I can. Like that is something that's like a very tangible thing you can do to support the art market slash world. You know, you'll support a gallery, you'll support an artist, which will allow them to continue to make work. So I don't want to discredit that element, but yeah, there are so many other ways that you can support artists. And some of them probably like feel maybe better. Like if you're going to go to a studio visit and then like show up for that artist at their opening and like tweet about it or write a post or do an Instagram or like write them a lovely email saying how much the work means. Like we can't just exist on money. We also need those other kind of forms of support, mental, emotional, sometimes physical, offer to help move some art.
Going back to the artists and creators idea, one thing like with the newsletter I do, sometimes people will sign up and like I send out the automated welcome email and it's like, what would you like to see us write about, people you'd like to see us cover, whatever. And sometimes I'll get people who like are painters or something and they are like, oh, I'd love to see you cover more like artists in here. And I don't really, because I haven't found anywhere like I'm always looking for an angle where there's something interesting about the way they're using digital content to build a business, right? Or like how they've built their audience. And so many of the, like when I think of artists who have done that in a really interesting way, it's usually on Instagram, and it's like there's not necessarily anything for me to like write about and extract that like other people trying to build a business around content can learn from, because it's like, oh well, they paint really beautiful paintings and then they post them and people like that. Which I think I probably have some blind spots there though. So I'm curious if you think there are any like artists who do Instagram best these days or some other social platform. But
oh gosh. I mean, that's a good question that I might like need a minute to like think about. Yeah. I mean, there are like the trends on TikTok of people like hiding their paintings and then like doing a slow reveal.
Yes.
Those are interesting. It's slightly different market artists. Like there are like more like independent artists that are maybe selling directly off of their website, whereas I do like write mostly about people that are existing in like more of like an art fair and like gallery system. But I did find that that was interesting. There is like something about like a buildup of like a surprise. You were like looking at the person and maybe making a judgment about what kind of art they made. And then you got a big reveal. So maybe there is something interesting,
frankly,
about that format.
When I see those though, it's like, I guess I'm going to be rude here. It's like usually the art isn't that interesting or that good, and it's more about the video. It's more about the TikTok, whatever. Like the classic example I think of is the fucking guy who like hangs from a trapeze with like a giant bucket of paint, and like the canvas is rotating under him, and he's just like dumps this bucket, and it's like, and apparently this, you know, he sells them and whatever, and he has a market for that. But that's just like, come on, what am I gonna? There's nothing. You're making a good, you know, 10-second video, and that's what this is. And you're pouring so like 5 gallons of paint. I don't know. I think so. It kind of goes back to like the artist creator, the creator entrepreneur artist spectrum, where it's like somebody like that is like very good at making their his medium isn't painting. It's TikTok videos, right?
Yeah. I don't think I would recommend for any artist that wants to be like serious about being in the art market to be on TikTok. necessarily. Like, I think that it is too commodifying. Like, you want a little bit of mystery if you want to be like, there's so many different ways to be an artist. But I love artists that like don't just share their own work, but they also share about the history of art, like what other artists they're looking at. And they like kind of give us a little peek into the way that they think about art. I find that really beneficial.
Well, one of my favorite, I don't think he's so active anymore, but for years, Brad Phillips, and he had his Brad Phillips group show Instagram account.
Canadian.
Yeah. Canadian artist. And, I've discovered so much interesting art through that. And I think he stopped years ago.
I read his book last year. Did we talk about it? I
don't know. Essays and Fictions.
Yeah. Very same.
Yes. I did read it. Who I lent it to? Harrison the Dare. He never gave it back to me 4 or 5 years ago.
That explains a lot.
You know, then he got
famous. I know people that are like in that book as like pseudo figures and like not in a good way. They're kind of like, oops. he's controversial figure. I mean, you need some controversy. He speaks his mind and that's great. Yeah. I love like a writer that's also a fiction, an artist that's a fiction writer.
Yeah. It's a rare figure. He fell off my map. I don't know why.
I don't know. I don't think he posts as much anymore.
No, because he was. I mean, that was like a different era of Instagram too. Like, I guess when I think about when I was looking at his Instagram, it was like 2017 through 2021 or something.
Mm-hmm. It's true that the group shows are a great way to discover people. Like, if you have one person who's like slightly more known than the other people, like it's like a great way to like
elevate.
Yes, yeah. The tide that lifts everyone.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's important. Actually, now I do have an Instagram answer because I'm writing a piece on Anna Wyant, Chloe Weiss, and Janine Brito, all three Canadian artists doing
the three horsewomen of the art market apocalypse.
But they post in an interesting way, right? Because they're both like, they're showing their paintings, which are of themselves and their friend groups, and they're also posting that same content. So the Instagram grid really does become, I think I want the title of the article to be Painting the Grid, because
that's smart.
And it's like what came first, right? Like people want to opt into their lives because it's like a beautiful, interesting lives that they're living. And then they're also painting it. So it's allowing these multiple places of access into what they're doing, who they're hanging out with.
These are all paintings that fit so well into just looking at it on your phone in like a few inches of space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually wrote about Anna's way of doing that a little bit in a piece, an essay I wrote called Aurora, that touched on Andrew Wyeth, where he was painting his neighborhood and his neighbors, like Christina's World, that's a painting of his neighbor, which I mean, like,
my favorite painting ever after like seeing it when I saw it in person for the first time. I don't think I've ever seen a painting in person that I'd seen, you know, reproduced as an image so many times. Like never have I had such a shock of like seeing it in person being like, holy shit.
It stands up.
It's amazing. But he was considered like really way too sentimental and old fashioned for the time, and was sort of like beefing with the ABEX movement, you know. But now we have like the painters that Tatum's writing about, and they are sort of depicting their social scene in the same way that he depicted his neighbors, but it feels very different because of that online and parasocial element, where like in the course of like going to a gallery and seeing Christina's World during that era, there's no opportunity to form a parasocial relationship with her or the subjects of the painting, or to sort of like try to like map out the scene. But Instagram makes it so easy to map out a scene based on who's liking who and pictured with who.
Yeah. I mean, they're not sentimental paintings, but it does make me think, Kieran, my husband, one of his exhibitions title was Towards Sentimentality, which I thought was really sweet. Like leaning into that sentimental nature, because he also kind of paints his life and our life together, which I have to grapple with sometimes.
There's a painting that Kieran did of Tatum's, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Marimekko shower curtain. Yeah, that I think iconic about like all the time.
I know. I want a sponsorship from Marimekko.
Oh, they could arrange 100% that. Sure.
I was looking at his Instagram before this when I was reading your writing and stuff to come up with some questions. And I was blown away. It's really beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I agree. I kind of like was thinking I'm a bit of a Nepo wife.
No, that's not true.
There's a lot of value that I get out of being married to an artist. And like, just, I learn so much about the art world through him. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask about, you've written about like the right and wrong way to do criticism. Obviously, like one thing that you can do for an artist that you believe in is like write about their work. Although like not so much in the art industry, but like in the music industry right now, there's the whole like, they don't build statues of critics thing where it's like, oh, actually the critic and artist are like at odds. But, you know, as somebody who believes in like good criticism, like how else are you going to discover new things?
Criticism.
And you give sort of four loose guidelines for negative critical reviews, which is no punching down. Does the angle speak to a larger issue or trend? Would I find writing about the work interesting? And is there something else I would rather be writing? And I mean, I think these are great rules for like any criticism. But yeah, I'm curious to hear how like you've been applying that or what the feedback was on that post.
Yes. I mean, I've been thinking about that a lot lately. And I think to expand on it, what I've been articulating to myself is like good faith versus bad faith criticism, which I think that really those rules just boil down to, am I doing this in good faith to try to like create a conversation or to try to like push the art world or somebody to like be better? Or is it just like kind of needlessly being catty? Obviously you wouldn't want to do the latter, but I think that we're in an environment right now that everybody thinks it's bad faith criticism if you say anything negative. Like I wrote a review of the Toronto Biennale for the Toronto Star, and privately I had people emailing me being like, thank you for saying that out loud. We agree. Like hopefully they can be better. But publicly I had people being like, how dare you? They're trying their hardest and you've just like come up like and just are being so negative. And I'm like, and somebody said like, well, everyone's a critic, aren't they? I'm like, well, yes, I'm like literally an art critic. So that is my job. And that's what I'm doing. And it's in good faith. It's like, I'm not just being mean for the sake of it. I'm just saying, I think that this can be better and this is how it can be better. And that's something valuable instead of something that's harmful. And of course, like, yeah, we've also seen it with like the reaction to like Dean Kizik. Some of it was like really like valuable. Like I've seen response essays that really get into it and like open up a conversation. But then I've seen like some pretty like vile, like knee jerk responses, which is just like, you know, how dare you say anything?
I'm thinking of the about a year ago, Lauren Euler's No Judgment essay collection came out. And then it was Anne Minov, the writer, who
Becca Rothfeld, both of them sort of ethered it.
Yeah, and to me it's like it was just so funny reading it. I read the book and I enjoyed it. I don't think it was like the greatest
essay
collection
ever. You enjoyed it without judgment?
But I read it and I enjoyed it. And then, you know, I read the Aminov's like, you know, scathing review and I enjoyed that too. And I was like, everybody's winning here. Like she got to write a fun, very negative review. Lauren Euler got to write her book and have it written about and discussed. Like I don't know. People were discoursing like, oh man, yeah, those essays were so bad. Like she really got her with that review. And it's like, no, they both, I don't know. To me, it's like you write the thing. You should hope it gets criticized. You should hope somebody takes a critical view. And like, I don't know. I think people need to have thicker skin. It's like the whole poptimism thing, right? It's like the past decade plus culture of like, no, everything has its value, which I think I like was stuck in for a while. Like I remember in college studying like rhetoric and media and being and, like reading Montaigne and have being obsessed with like the idea of subjectivity. And like, I remember thinking that like, oh, taste is like what anybody has a specific taste, and like anything that somebody thinks is good, you can like put yourself in their shoes and like reconstruct like who they are and their worldview by assuming it's good and like kind of backing out from that into why it might be good. So I was obsessed with that idea for a while. And now like, I feel like for the past 5 years or so, I've been trying to dispel myself of that and return to like, no, things are bad and things are good, and it's, you should have judgments on that, and they won't be the same as other people's judgments, but like you should need to have your judgments of what's good, what's bad, and why, and like understand the specific like material and ideological reasons that you think that.
You mean setting out like, I mean, but that's separate from reviewing whether somebody actually achieved what they set out to do. Like, you're saying that it's actually okay for to say they achieved what they set out to do, but what they set out to do was shitty.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Well, you know who's going to be in the hot seat soon is Andrea Long Chu. Mm. Her book's coming out. And I think some people are kind of going to come out of the woodwork, yeah, with the pitchforks. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Criticism, good.
I mean, it's also, I mean, if you dole it out, you should be able to take it. People sometimes are not happy with things that I write. And I'm like more than happy to hear from them. I think it actually like brings the temperature down. Like people expect like me to be hostile back to them. And when they realize that like I will be open to a conversation, I notice people like calm down immediately. And I'm like, yeah, now we're having an interesting conversation. Yeah. You've maybe taught me something, or I'm like saying, you know, this is what I think. And it's also like, I'm like, it's just, thank you. Like you're engaging with me. Like that is always going to be a good thing. Like, you're reading what I'm writing and like following what I'm up to. Like, thank you. There's no like bad. It's okay if you don't agree with me.
Yeah.
We sent a prior Tasteland guest Greta Rainbow to the Cy Twombly opening at Gagosian.
Yes, I read it. It's so good.
I mean, what I like about doing like a scene report is she was like really reviewing the scene and not the art. And she talks about in it, like, is it even worth offering a review of a Cy Twombly in 2025? Like, there's no controversy about whether he's a good artist or what he achieved. So a major theme of the report is more of a review of the experience, which was completely dry, apparently, and nobody had anywhere to put their coat. So if you're listening, Larry Gagosian,
get some coat.
Tell us who's going to be your predecessor.
Yeah, who's your successor? Who's your successor?
Do you have theories?
No, I have no theories.
Come on, throw out some fun. Throw out some fun.
It's probably somebody already at Gagosian that we've never heard of.
Never heard of. It's going to be somebody.
Does he have children?
No. He had Anna Wyatt for a minute, but.
Oh, they broke up?
Yeah.
Mm. Rip.
I mean, okay, it was dry. I've been hearing about this a lot this week, about these like New York galleries are no longer serving alcohol, and people are like, feels like it's like headline news in the art world.
Recession indicator.
I mean, we're still serving alcohol in Canada.
I'm coming right over.
I was at Foreign Domestic a couple months ago, and let me tell you, they ran out of Modelo quick, but they did have Modelo in a plastic tub with ice in it.
Just what everybody wants at an opening is like a warm beverage that's supposed to be cold. But no, I mean, I feel like that scene report was about the hierarchy of like who has access to certain things, because, you know, somebody's still getting that glass of champagne. Somebody has a place to put their coat. And I liked that it wasn't like overly like critical of that hierarchy. I think everything has a hierarchy. Like your library, like if you go in there every day, they're going to recognize you and put your favorite books on hold for you. It's not just about like how much money you spend, but it's how much of a community member that you can be. And then I do think there are different like tiers of access that you get.
100%. Everyone needs a gallerina in their life. My best friend is sort of a graduated from gallerina, but you know, for a long time, I still use like my headshot that I basically always still use is like me inside the Karl Lagerfeld exhibition at Carpenter's Workshop Gallery. Why was I there on a Sunday? Because my friend worked there, and I have lots of pictures of me in that beautiful space. So, and I always had somewhere to put my coat when I went to her openings. So, you know, gallerinas are cash poor and coat room rich.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I like to say like, in terms of socioeconomic status, a lot of us have really high socio status and very low economic status. But the people with high economic status want our socio status. It's just the full, you know, we've gone full circle. Like that's really, we're just sharing our status together.
This is, okay, this touches back on my favorite themes, which I didn't come up with, but I wrote about in my newsletter a couple months ago. Kate Eichhorn, media theorist, is where I got it. But the idea of content capital, which is like a third thing in there, right? Which I was writing about it in the context of like on Instagram, Twitter, whatever, like your content capital is your following, your reach, your ability to, you know, turn your content capital into material capital, or social capital, any form of capital, really. Where I kind of end up on it is that, you know, the only kind of pure gold bullion form of content capital is emails, right? Going back to newsletters. But I don't know. Now I'm thinking of this like in the context of a lot that we've been talking about today, like the Chloe Wise is like, that's such a like content capital that become like, that's a type of painting that maybe, I mean, I don't know, maybe it wouldn't, if it was like a vacuum, this wouldn't have been what happened. But maybe if you're making work like that, and you don't have the connections to the galleries, whatever, already, because it's like you can accrue content capital with this work that looks really good on Instagram, then that's very easily translatable into cultural capital, financial capital. I don't know, content capital first art.
Yeah. You never want somebody to be disappointed when they see your art in person, though. Like, it would be dangerous to make art too good for Instagram, because you're just going to let people down.
I was reading one of the comments on one of your newsletters, I forget which one, earlier. It might have been the predictions one. And somebody had said, like, what about AI and art and like AI art? And like, obviously that is related to people who make purely digital things. But it's like with paintings, it's like, well, it doesn't matter, because you could have an AI generated reference image, but you still have to make the brush strokes, right? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. What did I reply to the person?
You did. It was pretty neutral.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
On that note.
On that note, this is Tasteland.
This has been Tasteland. See you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.